Help DEA keep our communities safe and healthy by participating in National Prescription Drug Takeback Day, Saturday, October 25th. Take action right in your own home by cleaning out your medicine cabinet of unneeded medications. Keep them safe, clean them out, take them back. Find a collection site near you at DEATakeback.com. Do your part to lower overdose deaths and prevent prescription drug misuse before it starts. That's DEATakeback.com.
First, I want to say thank you for not saying anything about my black eye. I don't know if you noticed, but...
it doesn't over left?
I think it's this one.
Just a little.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's starting to fade away a little bit.
Oh, okay. Well, I hope you didn't have a disagreement with somebody over a piece of fake news or false narrative.
No. It was... No, not this time, I will say. Yeah, it was at training. I train in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
Oh, okay.
And I took a lot of time off. I was gone for like a month or just I was injured, so I took some time off. And then, of course, first day back, I get a black eye.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, no. That's not fun. And from practicing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wow. Yep. Are you a Cobra Kai fan?
I've heard of it, but I've never watched it.
You've never watched Cobra Kai?
I've never watched it.
Oh, Chris, you've got to put it on your to-do list. It literally is the same person, you know, who starred in The Karate Kid, you know, and it, all acting today and very creative. It's almost like a cartoon, though. It's a little with the karate and the high school students. It's almost like you're watching a real cartoon, but it's very good. Yeah, it's very good.
Is that on YouTube?
I think it's Netflix.
Oh, Netflix.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah. And it's going strong.
Yeah,
it's a lot of fun.
Still getting renewed. You know, they're still making it.
They're still making it, and I think because of the characters, you want to believe that they're believable.
Yeah. Well, I remember I have seen, you know, the movies. It's been a while, but. Yeah, the movies were legendary.
Oh, legendary. Yeah. So this is a whole franchise. This is a whole brand now of Cobra Kai. Yeah.
Now I got to watch this series. Yeah. Jeez. Well, really quick, welcome everybody. My name is Chris. This is Chitash. And today I am joined by a guest author of Biases All Around You, Dr. Eric Bean.
Yes. For the very virtue of my Doctorate of Education degree. So nice. Just, I like to tell everybody, just like Jill Biden.
Oh, okay. Biden,
yeah.
Because she is a psychologist?
She has a doctorate in education, and she's a community college instructor. And there was a little debate during the 2020 election where people thought that she didn't have any right to use her doctor name. For only because it's not a medical degree, it's a philosophical degree. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, that's the degree I have.
is that a big like point of contention with people? Like, oh, you should only use doctor if you're like an MD or a DO.
You know, I think most people there are people who don't use the designation. I basically only use it maybe for my students. My next door neighbor knows me as Eric. So, but I think if you have if you worked hard for the degree, whether it's a philosophical one, you should be proud of it. But, you know, PhD sometimes has been called piled high and deep, and we don't want anybody to be piled high and deep. So,
I've never heard that before.
Yeah.
Wow. Is that like piled high and deep and like...
I guess intellectualism.
Oh, okay.
Right. So, anybody that earns a doctorate degree, you're just really earning it in one specific area that you become very knowledgeable on, you know, whether it's education. As a matter of fact, one of the counselors, who is one of my counselors where I earned my doctorate degree, she was earning her PhD in the French horn.
Wow.
So she was a doctor of the French horn.
Okay. Wow.
And I guess you could be a doctor of anything now.
That's really cool.
It was pretty cool.
I wish I was musically inclined to have that level of skill at something in music. I don't have a musical bone in my body, though.
I'm right behind you.
Really?
Yeah. No, I'm told I can't sing in tune, but at least I enjoy the rhythm.
Yeah. No, yeah, I still, you know, I love music. I listen to mostly hip-hop, but I like a little bit of everything, though. Don't mind country, don't mind rock and roll. But if you ask me to play, like a guitar, piano, what have you,
Yeah, it's another language. There's no doubt.
Yeah.
You know, and but I wish there was more folk music today because, you know, I think we'd be debating some of these controversial issues that are circling all over the internet, and I think they'd be weaved into our contemporary music. But for some reason, some of these artists seem to be missing the cue. I'm waiting for the disinformation song or the misinformation song. But so if anybody's listening, maybe you'll take up the cause.
Just make an entire album around that theme.
That whole theme, yeah. Wouldn't that be? Yeah, that would be the way to do it. You do like 7 to 10 tracks, build it around false narratives, build it around fallacies, build it around, you know, the algorithms that control our lives now. So, and that's, of course, many of the subjects that my book talks about.
Yeah. And really quick to stay on that, I found this really interesting as music has changed it seems like it's changed really fast even since I was young, but even on a longer time span since that, I've heard somebody say it like this: now artists aren't making albums, they're making singles for playlists to go with what you were saying with the algorithm. So they are making music to get on Spotify playlists, Apple playlists, and the dynamic is kind of changing where, yes, I used to really like an album with a central theme, it flows really nicely, but now it doesn't feel the same because they're making the music to get on the playlist because that's where people are listening to them on. They're not going to their album. They're going to, you know, stuff I listen to like Rap Caviar or Top 40 on Spotify, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, so. Well, you know, we all need to be where the party is, you know, and wherever the party is, that's where the information goes. And, you know, it's like a super highway, and there's good information and there's bad information. And so wherever the party is, there's going to be more information. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think of social media like TikTok today. I know why they have a very powerful tool, because you can basically scroll through hundreds, thousands of different opinions and to see what's happening all over the world today. But we don't know what that does to people. You know, you'll see highs, you'll see lows, you'll see celebrations. It's so unfiltered, Chris, that I think they'll be studying it for many years to come. So, but I understand free speech, but and again, there's pros and cons, but we'll talk more about that along with the book.
Yeah.
But the problem is that there's nobody sort of watching over all of this, this melting pot of boiling information. Mm-hmm. And again, there's a lot of good stuff out there. You know, I can go on TikTok and I can find a hack that I never knew before, you know, for my computer, for my home.
Cooking.
Oh, anything. Yeah. Absolutely. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. You know, I could go on there and find out how to secure myself in Google so Google doesn't know what I'm doing. Just elixir. But there's also very shocking material in TikTok. Yeah. Very shocking material. You know, you see animals being born. You see animals fighting and dying. You could be scrolling and somebody could be videotaping their cancer. Mm-hmm. And so it's a powerful tool, and I don't think we want to go backwards, but this is where people, I think our mental health can be affected if we're not mature enough to understand all the information in front of us.
No, 100%. Yeah. 100%. Yeah. Getting getting into your book, really quick, what was kind of the spark? Was there a spark before writing the book?
Yes, no, there was. You know, for years I had been teaching English composition at the college level, also in dual enrollment high school with Wayne County Community College, online, on ground, also in other for other schools too, as well as K through 8, and now my recent experience as a high school English teacher. But what I found is that the quality of the sources my students were using were degrading. You know, they're, and I found that shockingly, you know, high schools are paring down their libraries, closing their libraries, and kids are just left to Googling. And of course, there's different ways we can search, you know, different types of understanding how to put in the nomenclature and using synonyms and things like that. But, you know, we still need access to databases, ProQuest, Digital Dissertations, EBSCO, which stands for the Elton B. Stevenson Company Database, ERIC, not named after me, but it was started by the United States government for research information. But not only do we need to give our kids access to that, they do need access to the internet and websites and things like that. But what they don't understand in many cases is they don't understand the biases that are, you know, right behind, you know, any of these blogs or corporations with the algorithms that they control. So that was part of it. Mm-hmm. The other part of the coin was going through my own social networks, I noticed somebody had posted something. They might have forwarded something for a candidate that they wanted to see reelected. But it ended up being information that was 5 years old or 6 years old. And they weren't aware of the date because they didn't inspect the information. They didn't, you know, basically vet the information. Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, these are people that I respect, some people in my own network. So that was it right there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that and the 2020 election, misinformation, misinformation associated with the pandemic, maybe civil unrest across the country, and just a general waning of civil discourse from civil to rude, because somewhere along the line, people have been given permission to just say rude things to each other, you know, colorful metaphors. I don't know who gave people permission to do this. Maybe it's for ratings. Maybe you think you can win an argument. But the truth of the matter is, most people win arguments based on what we call confirmation bias in their head. They search for the first piece of information that confirms their own bias, and they use that to win an argument, maybe in their head, but it may not be valid information.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then we have other personal biases. So that's how I got into the book, but I didn't want the book to be about our personal biases first and foremost. I wanted the book to be about the biases that surround all of us that we should all be aware of, regardless of what our personal biases are. But certainly the book and my website, you can test what your personal biases are. You can find out by answering 7 questions. If you go out to biashandbook.com/tools and scroll down, you can take the 7 question bias, personal bias assessment.
Mm-hmm.
And that will tell you how your inner circle affects your ability to interact with information. So that's how I got into it, Chris.
Wow.
I had to take my journalism background. I have a master's in journalism from Michigan State University, 1995. And then I went to the director of the School of Journalism, and I said, you know, Dr. Voss, will you write the foreword to the book? And he agreed. And, you know, he set the tone for what's happening. We all need an inner circle because there's so much information out there. We don't have time to vet it all. But we need to ask ourselves, do we have personal biases? Does anybody in our inner circle have personal biases? And I wanted the book to be short, only 57 pages, with just a one-page form where you can look at any piece of information and assess for the biases. And that took a long time to conceptualize what that might look like. But thanks to my editor, Sherry Wexler, thanks to my amazing illustrator, Gail Gorski, who hand cuts everything out of paper, I think we accomplished the job.
No, those illustrations, yeah, they were beautiful. And that was all just like cut paper?
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. You know what? Gail Gorski is an amazing artist. She sources paper from all over the world. This has been a craft, a hobby of hers for years, of cutting paper to make it look realistic. You know, whether it's an animal or a person or a scene in a room. And so she cuts the paper in such a way.
Mm-hmm.
Then she arranges it and she decides on shadowing. And if she was here, I'm sure she'd give you some more tips on that. But she shines a light on it. She stands on a chair, takes the picture, and there's a little bit of a 3D effect to it. And but they're very engaging. And mm-hmm. I think that she really... you know, she came along for the ride for our dedication to civil discourse, and I think she created some just amazing images that are very relevant.
No, they do look very, very nice, and I would not have guessed that that was paper.
Yeah, no, exactly. She's I've showed to my students. She's got a bulldog. Holding a magnifying glass on page 19. And yeah. I think you'll agree, Chris, that looks 100% like a real bulldog.
Yeah. No, it does.
Yeah, yeah. All out of paper. So I can't get over it either.
Beautiful.
But very fortunate to have Gail. She illustrated an earlier book called Ethan's Healthy Mind Express. I started a nonprofit in Michigan in 2019.
Mm-hmm.
That we're using for children that have what we call neurodiversity. We don't know why they're neurodiverse, but they think differently. And I named the organization after my son, Ethan. You know, we're currently using that for the book effort for a nonprofit and just spreading the word about autism, about the spectrum, the different ranges that affect children as well as adults.
Mm-hmm.
And but we just thought that publishing the book under the Healthy Mind Express imprint, which I started, was a good way to go because of it's, you know, I think we all owe our part to help people understand information because no matter what our education level is, information can outsmart anyone.
I like that.
Yeah.
Information can outsmart anyone.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because it depends on what's baked into it. And so I immediately, you know, thought, well, where do I want to begin this book? And basically in the first chapter, we talk about critical thinking, which some people haven't been exposed to as a concept, or people simply haven't done in a long, long time because we get so caught up in our fast-paced world that we forget to take the time.
Very fast, yeah.
So we're all guilty of hasty generalization, including myself, and which is a fallacy, whether you spread it or purposely, you know, produce a fallacy. And there's we talk about at least 10 of them in the book, but. Yeah, the critical thinking was a key factor in just re-explaining to people. And quite frankly, Chris, not everybody, you know, wants to learn how to vet information. You know, we don't, it's not something that's on the top of our mind. We have other things that we're doing. We assume we're interacting with information in a prudent and positive fashion. Some people forget that we should never use information to hurt people. We should only use information to help people. You know, and that's where that civil discourse comes into play.
Mm-hmm.
So the book starts off with critical thinking. And then, as I said earlier, since I was a teacher for many years, I had determined that based on the way that the internet was developing and my interactions with the information and with my students, I discovered that there are 7 sources of all information, no matter what format it comes your way.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a podcast, a video, it could be a radio, television show, newsletter, TikTok. So the 7 sources are academic, hidden agenda, for-profit, nonprofit, watchdog groups, which are like nonprofits, but I just separated them out a little bit because they have a slightly different purpose. They're watching over everybody. And the government publishes a lot of information, and then we have individuals like you and I. So any piece of information that we get, the first thing we want to do is categorize it. You know, what out of those seven sources of potential biases, which one does it fall under? And it may be one or two. Somebody may be an individual representing a for-profit. So it depends on how the information is phrased. Mm-hmm. So, but, and then I ask my students, and I don't have any scientific, peer-reviewed study on this, but out of all those seven sources, and we think of the internet, which one is likely to publish the most amount of information?
I was actually just about to ask you something like that. If, to answer your question, I would say maybe, I think the government publishes a lot.
Yeah, it's interesting, and if we have any schools out there, let me know. Okay, I know the University of Michigan has a School of Information. I plan on working with them in the near future. But,
oh, very cool.
But the I immediately think for-profit. So I think because we live in a for-profit world that when we think of the internet, but then I also have to think maybe individuals by now because everybody's doing a blog, everybody's on social media.
Yes.
Right? But the government, certainly I think that could be in the top three as well as... if we look at academic and the peer-reviewed publications and all those things, so forth. So, when you get a piece of information, if you're going to share it with your network, you need to put it through some tests. And so the book goes through how you can quickly test just by looking at it without even doing any further research on a piece of information. One quick tip is that... if you see a piece of information and there's no other source in it, no citation, no attribution, it's written in what we call an idiosyncratic fashion. It's just the person's opinion, right? Depending upon what the topic is, right? But if you see any piece that has citations and does say according to, even if it's from an individual, it's more homogeneous, and thus... for the fact that it's using other sources, we say it's a little less biased than a source that's just an editorial. The book includes another engaging way to use the Greek rhetorical styles in that fashion. So, and again, it's so easy. Anybody can learn how to or listen to any piece of information to with the Greek rhetorical styles, as the book will, explains. To also further ascertain the overall level of bias in the published piece of information.
With the Greek rhetorical that you were just referencing, is that in regards to the Klempp test that you talked about in the book?
Yeah, that is the Klempp test. Those letters stand for acronyms that are associated with how something is written, if you will, whether it has emotion, or whether it's more intellectually based, and it's based on logic and reasoning versus the date of the piece. And these are all things that we need to inspect and look at if we're going to forward a piece of information and tell our network to believe in it. We need to understand who created it, what purpose did that information serve, how authentic, how objective that piece of information is, and so forth. And the book can show you how to take out your own personal magnifying glass and inspect information so that you can say to yourself, based on that and my own personal biases, because you're going to score that too in the form, you can feel more confident if you're going to share information. So, it's a process that we all need to be responsible for because we should all be using information to help people, not hurt people. And we've seen lately that some people are using information to hurt people. So, University of Michigan breaks down information. They've got a nice published information on the Ypsilanti District Library site, where it says here, according to Fake News, Lies and Propaganda, How to Sort Fact from Fiction, a University of Michigan Library Guide, misinformation is inaccurate information shared without deceptive intentions. That's misinformation, right? And disinformation is false information intended to deceive. And that's according to Kristen, if I can pronounce her last name correctly, Fontachiro. I like that as far as breaking down misinformation and disinformation. But if we look at the first definition of misinformation, inaccurate information shared without deceptive intentions, we have to ask ourselves, if we immediately share a piece of information immediately after reading it, you know, we could be in a situation where we're deceiving people because we forgot to really properly vet the information. And so the book, Chris, talks about a mental process called cognitive dissonance. And in 1957, Festinger came up with this concept where he basically boiled down the concept of cognitive dissonance, which means that we behave differently than our thoughts. We behave differently than our thoughts. So the simplest example of that would be we eat a high-fat meal, even though we know it's bad for us. And then how do we feel afterwards? Well, we feel, you know, I shouldn't have eaten that, but we need to have fun, so it's all about moderation, right? Mm-hmm. And even a doctor will tell you that you can sit down and consume a large amount of fat as long as you go back to living a otherwise healthy lifestyle. But
I'd tell that to some of my keto friends.
That's it.
On the keto.
Well, I found out this term that I really enjoyed. There's a term that our food should be our medicine. That's an interesting concept,
yeah.
Huh? You know, but it's hard in our busy world. It's hard to prepare all that medicine.
Yes.
You know, getting back to cognitive dissonance, so the book on page 50, I liken this whole thing. If we're talking about misinformation, disinformation, if you don't vet an information, if you don't know that you put in the time to critically think about it, then why share it, right? So, you know, that could be a further extension of misinformation. But disinformation is you purposely send information that's designed to be deceiving, right? So, but on page 50 of the book, I ask everybody to consider that if you run into a theater, and I use, for whatever reason, a local example here in the Michigan area, but you run into any theater, mm-hmm. if you scream fire and there's no fire, obviously you'd be arrested, and that would be just a crazy, that'd be a crazy thing to do. I mean, you'd have to really, you know, want to hurt people in that situation. But then, you know, at the same time, if you're forwarding a piece of information that contains facts and statistics, but you didn't examine the facts or statistics further or look at who created the piece or in what context they created the piece or the conflicts of interest with the person who created the piece or a fallacy that could be baked into the piece, or if the piece was simply just sensationalized, you know, if you don't sit down to inspect that, you should and you forward it to your network, you should experience a little cognitive dissonance. And I would label that as, you know, a hybrid of misinformation, disinformation. So we simply can't be sharing information unless we've done our due diligence. You know, there was a case recently here in the Detroit area where a man, for whatever reason, hurt his family because he was obsessed with conspiracy theories.
I heard about
taking
that.
Taking it to an extreme, right? Mm-hmm. But you know, there are other people. This gets into rumors and innuendo, you know, and things. There'll always be rumors. There'll always things like that. You know, I understand, but. It's when we see information that's purposely, you know, published and sent out there that's just laden with the fallacies mm-hmm. that we talk about as well.
I just saw an example of this, too, on Twitter. Do you know who Dave Smith is?
I do not. No?
He's originally, I think he started out as stand-up comedian, podcast host, and now he's a major candidate, I think, for the Libertarian Party coming up in 2024. Oh, okay. And he shared a piece of information on Twitter, something to do with the events of what's happening in Ukraine right now. Mm-hmm. And then he actually made a tweet that I saw just recently, I think yesterday, saying, hey, the tweet that I sent yesterday about this information posted about Ukraine was actually wrong. I apologize for posting it. I should have vetted it before I posted it. And I thought, wow, that's kind of refreshing to have somebody say that, you know, just to
take accountability.
Yeah. I feel like, gosh, I don't really see that too often these days.
You know, the CDC did that recently with the pandemic. You know, they had indicated that they got some things wrong. And I think you're right. I think when they step up to the plate, that's a good thing. I think throughout the entire pandemic, throughout the 2020 election, you know, following the election, I think there should have been more town halls. I don't know if it's the television stations. I do know that six entities control about 90% of all the information.
That was staggering.
Exposed.
Yeah.
And we mentioned that in the book.
Yeah.
But I think that when you're talking about people stepping up to the plate saying that they mispost or they misshared, that is, it's good. It's good to hear that. Mm-hmm. Just like I think of that podcaster who recently was brought to trial because he had indicated that the shooting in Pennsylvania, what was the school system there? That it never occurred. He simply, so they took him.
Oh, Connecticut.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sandy Hook. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, he finally admitted in court that he believed it really happened. It really happened. So, but when you have mm-hmm. a large audience, you know, that's a big responsibility. Because, some people can be gullible. Some people, there's a term called sheeple, where people just sort of follow along.
I've heard that.
Yeah, you know. And so, and it may align with their biases, you know. So mm-hmm. then you follow along even further. Because, you know, how we, like you said, those artists are producing songs that are going to get them further up in the search engine optimization, right? That's what it's all about, search engine optimization, mm-hmm. so that people want to, you know, be exposed to the music and want to interact with it and so forth. So it's the same thing today, you know, with a lot of information. There can be deceptive trails leading you to it, like clickbait.
So
I wrote a paper in 2018, and I presented it at Oxford University, and it was just simply a paper on some possible rules that could be put in place for websites that, you know, purposely have fake news on them, I wrote the paper based on the fact that there could be fake ads, not just fake news. So the paper starts off with fake ads, which is clickbait to lead you to a certain other part of the internet, or to have you purchase something that you didn't intend to purchase in clickbait.
Yeah, I see those all the time on websites, like on the sides and stuff.
Yeah. You know, and then, you're just taken further down, you know, the internet highway. But so in the 80s and 90s, before the internet, if a newspaper was going to run a story that looked like, or an ad that looked like a story, that's how they did it back then. They made ads that looked like stories, but they were required to put the word advertisement on it, right? But since individuals can own websites, there's no way to police. You can't tell everybody to just simply put the word advertisement, you know. But, you know, this dovetails into what recently happened with Facebook when we had the whistleblower, and she explained that Facebook makes more money on the negative algorithms than the positive algorithms. And so, but so my paper in 2018, you know, suggested that websites, if they're taking paid ads, they could color the ads differently so that people knew that they were ads versus just something coming up in their feed.
Yeah.
So they can get an idea. So they can authenticate, imagine that, authenticate the piece of information more than anything else. But, you know, none of that legislation is in place. There's no mandate, you know. In the 1980s, Chris, the FCC had a... they had a policy, time will be applied to opposing views for local television stations.
Is this the fairness doctrine?
Well, it's related. Yeah. It was related to it. Yeah, well, fairness doctrine has to do with how much information can you take from someone else and use it on your own, you know, and if it's for an academic endeavor, you know, it's paraphrasing and quoting and properly citing your sources. And then, you know, as an instructor, you know, we have to determine is most of the paper is it overly quoted and there's not enough of the student in the paper or the intellect behind it. But when we think of the Fairness Use Act, in the 1980s, they wanted to literally, they wanted people to be able to come on the end of a newscast and give their opinion about the challenging topics of the day. So I'll never forget there was probably in late 70s, early 80s episode of All in the Family with Archie Bunker, who was one of those people from the community who came on at the end of the broadcast. And boy, did he give his opinion, biased as they were for a character like Archie. But the FCC eventually got rid of that policy because there's no way that anybody could ever provide enough space for opposing views, because there could be not only two sides to a story, four sides, 10 sides, there could be 20 sides to a story. We could have 10 people in a room together witness something. We could ask them all to write about it, and they might all write something differently of what happened right in front of them.
Yeah.
But yeah. Anyway, so time will be provided for opposing view. The television stations couldn't really, you know, they'd have lines of people. Give me a minute and a half. Give me a minute and a half. Mm-hmm. You know, so, but, you know, thankfully we have the internet. Now anybody can publish a blog. Anybody's work can potentially go viral. You can become a sensation on TikTok if that's what you want to do. But I'm telling all the people out there, when you're viewing all this material, you know, think about it, understand it, look at the conflicts of interest that might be associated. So you do need to do some background checking of some of these authors and understand there could be fake authors out there too. There could be fake websites out there because there's no way to police it all.
Yeah.
So, but if you come across a source where you can't identify the individuals who operate it, we call that a hidden agenda, you know, like QAnon, you know, they're not going to have an 800 number where you can call. I don't think I've never tested it, but you know, we have to understand even for my students, you know, I tell them you can't put a source in a paper if we can't identify who owns the website. It might be good information. Mm-hmm. We might be able to look at the root URL of the website, you know, which is the web address, and we might be able to say, oh, that's .edu, that's an educator. Okay, so you can put that it came from, you know, umich.edu or something like that, or MSU, since I'm ultimately really a Spartan.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, so, but all of these things, authenticating the information, and knowing what your personal biases are, too, is very important. Because sometimes we embrace information of what we call the halo effect or affinity bias. Halo bias, affinity bias. That's where you prefer the company of like-minded people.
Oh,
you know?
Okay.
And then you have the halo where, you know, it's not only like-minded people, but you have the same... maybe you have the same degree as somebody, same educational level, you drive the same kind of car, a BMW, a Cadillac, and you only listen to people who drive BMWs and Cadillacs. So things to think about. Anchoring bias is when you hold on to the first piece of information that confirms your biases that you use in an argument. So these are, you know, there's about five of these personal biases, and you have to rate that when you inspect the piece for its own biases.
Mm-hmm. That anchoring bias, that reminds me of, there's a thing in sales where your first, like, initial offer, that's like your anchor. So it's, some people say that that first initial number for whatever you're trying to purchase is so important, because it kind of dictates the rest of the conversation from there. If, like, for, you know, even like a salary negotiation, you can kind of sell yourself a little short if you throw out a number and your potential employer just says, oh yeah, we could do that, makes you kind of think, oh gosh, they said that so easily, maybe I could have gotten more money by anchoring it a little bit higher.
Well, that's it. They, you know, you should always, I guess, go out, you know, for negotiation is aim high.
Yeah.
You know, you know, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you don't want to lowball yourself.
Low, you know, yes.
For sure.
Yes.
But, yeah, no, the information conundrum today, you know, is that we all need to use information responsible, I like to think, in a prudent way. We need to use information with goodwill. Goodwill. We need to be stewards of the information, because it's a powerful job. You know, you're making recommendations to people. They may spend time that might be spent time elsewhere in their lives, because you gave them a piece of information and now they want to interact with it. They want to learn about it. And so you may not mean to circulate bad information. And sometimes it may be impossible 100% of the time. You know, in all fairness, if we look at the journalism industry, Chris, we see that reporters can publish stories, and when they list the attribution, they sometimes say, according to a well-known source. They don't really list the source, even in some of these journalistic pieces, right?
I've seen that, yeah.
Yeah, and they're doing it to protect the source. They're doing it to protect the source, but we have to trust them that they've done their journalistic due diligence and that they're objective and authentic, and, you know, that they've sort of sworn to this journalistic oath to mirror the news, not sensationalize it. And that's why we explain in the book that there were many newspapers across the country years ago, decades ago, that were called the Mirror, because they wanted to mirror what was happening, not reinvent what was that. But Chris, you and I, growing up here in the Detroit area, we've experienced this sensationalism with local journalists. I think of Channel 7 WXYZ, Bill Bonds was an anchor in the 70s and 80s, at least he was during my time.
I was going to say, and he sounds familiar, but
yeah,
No.
If you don't know, but he used to sensationalize the news, but ABC kept him because he was such he had a big following, you know, an audience that loved him. He's very charismatic. And in many cases, he spoke the truth, but he didn't always say that I'm now delivering an editorial versus I'm now delivering the news, you know. So, and he also starred in the movie Planet of the Apes. He was,
They
picked him because he was a well-known, he was in the national news before he came to Detroit.
Okay.
He's probably based out in L.A., And he said, I'm Bill Bonds reporting, the apes have escaped, or something along those lines in the very classic movie Planet of the Apes. Yeah.
Wow.
So with all information, you know, we have a big responsibility today, responsibility. Because, you know, our mental health is at stake. We could be following the wrong cause if we don't take the time to vet the information.
I remember you mentioned that in the book too, about following.
Yeah. Following false causes.
Yeah.
You know, we've got cognitive dissonance, which is, you know, we just talked about earlier, as far as, you know, how these, you know, interactions with information can affect people. And then we've seen these cases where people embrace these conspiracy theories and then they become, you know, mentally anguished, you know, over it too. So, but yeah, the book talks about, you know, misinformation or disinformation for that matter, obviously, can lead you to follow a false cause, mm-hmm. feeling foolish, can tarnish your credibility, attract the wrong people, create undue stress, compromise your values, harm your mental health. Mm. That's what's at stake. That's mm-hmm. that's a lot of risk out there when it yeah. comes to information. So, but this 57-page book, you can get right at the heart of the matter. Sherry Wexler wanted to make sure that the book was arranged like a handbook, that you can refer to it often, mm-hmm. and go to the chapters that you need to go to. If you're evaluating, you know, the different pieces, the book will help you understand, you know, all of the demarcations you need to look at.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it doesn't have to be a long process. And, you know, obviously, you know, you've already got news sources. People already have news sources where they get their information. But all information can be tainted. We need to understand that, you know, the news industry, we need to understand individuals, all of the seven sources,
mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. make wise decisions with the information. So,
going back to something you had said with the mirroring, it was mirroring and versus opinion or editorializing?
Editorializing, yeah. So, you know what? If we just look at the definition of bias, for example, mm-hmm. you know, what is bias? Bias is, bias for the individuals is holding on to information that hasn't necessarily been validated. It hasn't been validated. It's just a pre-existing thought about something without any firm trail of evidence that, you know, and our biases begin from the minute we're born. We're born into a family with biases, our faith. We're born into our community, our schools, and then that goes out to the media. That affects who we are and so forth. So... When we think of the bias, okay, are you making good decisions with information based on that you've vetted the information and understand the biases, or are you exemplifying a bias, haste makes waste, not doing taking the time needed, right, to validate the information? So a bias is either based on good information or bad information. So, you know, and it's okay. We all have our opinions on how our country should be run. We all have opinions on where our tax dollars should go to. You know, nobody's necessarily right or wrong. Well, you know, spend more money, don't spend more money, right? So, but there is a point where you know that the information may not be good enough to circulate, and the book can help you determine that, help you score mm-hmm. that.
You know what's tough sometimes? I like you use this example in the book about one study will tell you that, hey, this diet is not good. And right. then another study will come out and say, hey, actually, this diet does have some benefits.
It's a merit. Yeah.
And at that point, it's almost like, I guess maybe I should try it for myself and see the effects it has personally on me. And maybe it might not work. So then maybe yeah. I just ditch it for another diet.
Well, that's
something.
It. I mean, we live in a world. It's not a black and white world. There's gray areas. You know, when we look at these studies about diets and things, we need to scrutinize them. We need to inspect them. We need to vet them and understand that what organization created the study. If they're selling the product and they did the study, that's a conflict of interest, right? So, you know, or you know, if a corporation does their own internal research, you know, it can be valid information, but there's definitely a conflict of interest. If they hire an outside organization to do the study, that's less bias, you think, but then, you know, they are being paid to do it. Mm-hmm. So then how was the study conducted? You know, was it rigorous?
Yeah.
Was there a trial? Did they operationalize the information correctly? Did they tie it to current literature? Do the peer-reviewed publications that publish the information work with a variety of different authors, or do they tend to be a little bit more idiosyncratic and work with authors that they know? Nepotism and cronyism, you know, can be baked into these publications too. But mm-hmm. when it comes to studies, if that's all we have, and because studies are time-consuming and studies cost a lot of money, then, you know, we can hope that we can draw some good information out of any study, but we still have to make sure that we knew if there were conflicts of interest in the study and so forth. So, and, you know, we're not talking about that everybody has to have a doctorate degree in order to analyze a peer-reviewed article, but if you use the bias assessment form in the book, for example, that can, you can tell, you know, you could look at the sources of any peer-reviewed article and see, do they tend to publish only people that they're familiar with? Not that there's anything wrong with that, but, you know, how come they don't give other people a chance to get published too, the newer people that might have good information and good studies?
Yeah.
You know, so, but it's, you know, all of this is all part of, again, saying to yourself, then I've got to do a better job of inspecting information.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but yeah, good point. You know, the studies, oatmeal is good for you one day, but if you eat too much of it, it could, you could gain weight. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, even with the whole cholesterol, you know, everybody went on a low fat diet, low cholesterol. And then they came out with another study. And this is erroneous. I can't validate this, but I thought I heard, see, I'm authenticating my message here.
Yeah.
I heard that there's an ingredient in egg yolk that lowers your cholesterol. So that's a, you know, that's a conundrum.
Yeah.
There's an ingredient inside of the cholesterol that lowers your cholesterol. So, but, you know, it's all about, for diets, getting back to which diet is good, you know, it is about moderation. We know that the diet industry is huge, vitamins, minerals, other elixirs, you know, and all these different, you know, over-the-counter, you know, pills to lose weight. You know, there was the company who makes their product out of jellyfish for memory. I forgot the name of the product.
Oh, yeah.
I think I need to take their product.
Like yeah.
So, but they, and we don't have to mention names. You could, but initially they were sued because they couldn't really stand behind the research on whether or not the jellyfish ingredient helps people with their memories. The bottom line is that, you know, maybe there is valid information to say that it can help. Maybe it's not, but we need to look who created the study and if anybody else has duplicated that study to see if the results were similar.
Yeah.
Right? You know, that's another thing. But these studies are very expensive. Anything, you know, a team of researchers, you know, you need qualified people that can write the material and understand the results too. You know, so
I used to work in a research lab actually. So yeah, it adds up quickly.
No, it really does. And but you know, there's information. I think right now, you know, I've been seeing a lot of information on in the astronomy world that because of the Webb telescope that was launched. It's, you know, a million miles, the unprecedented photos of our, the entire, our galaxy and beyond. That's breaking all sorts of rules. So I bet you the academic world, you know, is publishing a lot of papers, turning it upside down right now. So, on all these theories that are out there.
Oh, yeah.
So, but yeah, there's always, you know, something out there, but, you know, when I was growing up, we took more time to even vet the journalistic sources. You know, there were fewer sources than there are today, but we had to jump in our car and get a newspaper, or we had to have it delivered. And so already we've taken more time to interact. So if we took the time back then, just use that time today when you're on the internet to vet the information, because you don't have to get in your car to find it, mm-hmm. right? Take that time and switch it to saying, hey, do I want to look at other outliers, other places I can go to validate this information? And the book shows mm-hmm. you how to do that too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One final thing. Are your plans after this book, do you see another book in your future regarding this kind of same topic?
Well, what I'd like to do is I'd like to work with other institutions to help students, researchers, people all over understand the best ways to investigate information. So in my head, I'm thinking I'd rather put in the time to, you know, work with schools to be available to them. There's other nonprofit initiatives to help people debunk misinformation. That's where I see putting my time in after the book. I am speaking locally here in Ann Arbor on October 25th at 6:00 at the Mallets Creek Library. And I will be presenting in St. Louis a day before November 11th, which is November 12th, which is a Saturday. I'll be presenting to the National Education Association of High School Journalists portion of the book. The word is spreading. It's a challenge with a micro publisher that I am, which is self-published. But, you know, thankfully, we won a 2022 Nautilus Book Award Silver Medallion.
I remember you telling me that, yeah.
Yeah, that's a...
That's awesome.
That's a book award that's been out for over 22 years, and some heavy hitters have also earned a silver or a gold. We're very thrilled to be among them with my team. We also just won a 2022 Silver Medallion from Reader's Favorite, which is another big website that reviews books on an annual basis. And even selected Jim Carrey one year as a prize winner on their site.
Very cool.
And then I recently became a 2022 Henry Ford Innovation Nation first place teacher for my information bias studies associated with this book. So it's good to get recognition there. But it's a topic that I think goes beyond my recognition, obviously. It goes way into, I want everybody to be recognized as good stewards of information. And I hope to help everybody, whether it's one person at a time.
Well, that's awesome, yeah. Eric. Congratulations on those awards. That is very, very cool. Very,
you,
very
Chris.
Impressive.
Appreciate that. Yeah, it doesn't happen, you know, too often. So I was thinking to myself, I'm going to quit while I'm ahead in that respect, but I'm going to put the time needed into helping everybody do a much better job interacting with information.
That's awesome. Eric, where can people find the book? Where can people find you? I know you mentioned a website earlier.
Yeah, you can go to biashandbook.com. You can always email me at my personal email address, which is profbean@gmail.com. You can buy the book on Amazon as a paperback. It's also available in hardcover through Barnes & Noble. Libraries can get it through Baker & Taylor distributor, as well as Ingram. Any retailer can get the book. Walmart can get the book. Target can get the book if they just order it through Ingram and make it available to their customers. Get this in the hands. You know, in the 2022 Nautilus Book Award, we won for young adult nonfiction. And so, you know, as a nonprofit effort, this is a perfect book for any high school student anywhere in the country to gravitate towards before they set out there into college and in the real world to have themselves armed.
Nice. I will include links to the in the description of the video that you just mentioned. And are you on any social media that you want people to follow you on?
Yeah, in Facebook, you can just type in Bias is All Around You, and you'll get to our website. Cool. Feel free to follow us there. I welcome anybody that wants to leave a review of the book, because as an independent publisher, you know, we need those reviews. We're a nonprofit effort. All the money earned goes towards a great cause. So, you know, please feel free. The book's also available as an audiobook for as cheap as $6. It's That's a 72-minute awesome. Unabridged edition of the book on audio. So you can even listen to it in the car.
Yeah, that's really cool. Audiobook is huge these days.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Chris, thank you so much to be here and to do this recording with you. I'm very grateful and pleased, and I can't wait to, you know, listen to the end result.
No, thank you very much, Eric. I really appreciate you coming down here, taking the time to do this. And I enjoyed your book. I learned a lot from it. I hope to now go out into the world and use the techniques that you had illustrated in the book. So thank you. And for everybody out there, thank you for listening. My name is Chris. This has been Cheatash. Take care, everybody.